Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm CJ, one of the hosts for the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Liat Ben-Moshe about her new book, Decarcerating Disability, Deinstitutionalization, and Prison Abolition. With the discussion of this book, I really just wanted to say, first of all, that it's such an engaging work, and I really hope that people pick it up after we have this discussion. But without further ado, Dr. Liat Ben-Moshe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Liat, I was wondering if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, a bit about your background before you even were considering this tome.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm currently a professor in criminology department, criminology, law, and justice in University of Illinois, Chicago. And I'm based in Chicago, is where I live and where this interview is being conducted right now. And I am trained as a sociologist, as kind of a humanistic social scientist, as it were. And I have background in kind of interdisciplinary fields, particularly disability studies, med studies, gender studies, and sociology. So that's kind of about my scholarly pursuit. I should say that I'm not from the US. I came to the US to pursue graduate work. And I just never left. So some of my kind of really interest in some of these topics came from just pure curiosity. You know, the U.S. being like a mass incarcerator of the world, and also learning about disability movements and disability culture and disability arts was all something kind of new to me. So that was, you know, just to kind of give a little bit of a preface. I also consider myself really a scholar activist. So my scholarship is meant to be activist, but I also do a lot of stuff that's not scholarship that, you know, might be read more as activist work. But I really, for the purposes of this podcast, I really hope that the scholarship itself would be seen as also activist work.
Yeah, that's great to know. I was wondering if you could tell us then how you came about this specific sort of framing of this book. And so how did you come to write Decarcerating Disability? And what made you feel as though this was a book that needed to be written?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I kind of... I always thought it's a book that needs to be written. And like I think I said it in other interviews, but, you know, I never thought I would be the person writing this book that needed to be written. The reason why I thought it's needed, Decarcerating Disability is about the connection between two major decarceration movements in the U.S. One is deinstitutionalization, and I want to preface this by saying that when I say deinstitutionalization, I mean three things. First of all, I mean the closure of psychiatric institutions, but also institutions for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And often when we talk about the deinstitutionalization, people only think about psychiatric facilities and only think about hospitals. But there's a long history of both oppression and resistance in the deinstitutionalization of people with intellectual developmental disabilities. So that's number one for deinstitutionalization. So it's the closure of these facilities over time in the US. But secondly, it's also the shift from sending people to institutions, the shift from that into community living. So it's not just the closure of facilities. It's also kind of a shift in our ideology and understanding of the kind of the worth of people with disabilities. But then number three, deinstitutionalization is also, to me, a social movement, or particularly a logic. And the reason why I say that to answer your question about why this book is because I don't think people understand deinstitutionalization as those things. I don't think, first of all, that there's people connect psychiatric deinstitutionalization to deinstitutionalization and intellectual disabilities. There's really wonderful people who do a history of one or the other, but not both, even though they're very much related to each other. And certainly, I haven't seen people who connect that to what the premise of the book is to connect deinstitutionalization to prison abolition. And so I started to be more active in both of those movements, both kind of disability rights and then later disability justice movements, being connected more to disability culture, the kind of political arm of disability in the US especially, and then then becoming more connected to anti-prison work, particularly prison abolition. And I saw that there's so much connections between those two movements and these two ideologies, but yet there's hardly anybody in that intersection. I mean, of course, there's always been a few, but very, very few. And definitely nobody who's done a scholarly analysis of how those two things are connected. And so for the longest time, I was really, again, especially as a non-American, was really waiting for somebody to do that work that's not me. But as I became more entrenched in the movements, it became clearer to me that I should just write it. And if somebody, you know, by the time this is published, there's another thing, then great. And I should say that Anne Parsons' book, for example, which talks about kind of similar themes, but really in more in the relationship between psychiatric institutionalization and the rise of incarceration. So her book is not about abolition, but her book came like a year or so before mine. So people have been working simultaneously, but it's definitely not something I set out to do like in my youth or something like that. It's really just as being an embedded person in both the movements made me feel like there's a gap here and the gap would be helpful for the movements to understand each other.
Yeah, it's very fascinating just being sort of like in two places at once, giving yourself that particular position to consider both simultaneously. And you did that so well. I was wondering if you could, you know, by getting into some of the material of the book, if you could talk, I guess, first a little bit about this history of deinstitutionalization. And, you know, I think in the Perfect Storm chapter, you talk about some of the, there's many, of course, causes or forces here in this deinstitutionalization process. It's not ever fully formed, but if you could talk about, you know, some of these issues around new policy, especially around the Kennedy administration, some of the financial changes, as well as the lawsuits, and even within psychiatry, thinking about the changes to psychiatric treatment and psychiatric drugs, right? So, yeah, if you could just give us a little bit more insight into this process of deinstitutionalization.
Sure. So, like I said, one of the goals really in the kind of earlier chapters of the book. So I should preface this again by saying that the book offers a genealogy. I'm not a historian, so this, you know, really offers a genealogy of deinstitutionalization. And what I mean by genealogy, I mean in a very kind of Foucauldian, I mean Michel Foucault, idea of an idea, by the way, he took from Nietzsche, of course, that it's the history of ideas, right? Like, how do ideas kind of travel and circulate, ideas or discourses and so on. And so it's not so much kind of a historical pursuit to try to find what caused the deinstitutionalization.
Right.
Because I think much like, you know, how you asked the question, that it's really an unanswerable question. And that's why I call the chapter The Perfect Storm. But more than that, the way that people have been asking the question obscures what they actually want to know. If that makes sense. And so sometimes people put the finger on this is what led to the deinstitutionalization, or this is what led to the deinstitutionalization, when to me the really important question as a genealogist, maybe as opposed to a historian, is why those things, right? Like, why do people highlight the particular things that they highlight in their genealogies or historiographies? And why not other things? And by other things, I particularly mean what I talk about in the second chapter, which is the movements, the ideologies, the knowledges of people with disabilities, people who are institutionalized, imprisoned people, and so on. Why not focus on those things as also engines to deinstitutionalization? So to me, it's not like I'm saying those things caused deinstitutionalization. I think a lot of things caused deinstitutionalization. And I would also say that one thing that, you know, that could be a critique of the book, but I was trying to kind of tell a very general story. And one thing that I learned by doing this research over the years is that the U.S. is very big. And it's very big, and it's actually contradictory. So things that happened in, like, let's say Illinois, which is where I am today, doesn't at all represent what happened in Texas, for example, or California. Or so some of the things that I might say now in answer to your question might not, or all your questions, might not resonate to particular people, like where they live and the history of deinstitutionalization in their state. And this is, you know, just another thing to contribute to the fact that deinstitutionalization didn't happen in the same way everywhere. So it's impossible to answer the question, how did it happen? In some states, it kind of never did. You know, there's a bunch of states that never closed the majority of their institutions for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Illinois is a pretty, you know, good example of that. They did close some institutions, I should say, but it's not a leader in deinstitutionalization. And you know, some states closed all of their institutions for people with intellectual disabilities, and most of their institutions for people with psychiatric disabilities. So it really is so very varied. And one of the goals for this chapter was to create a genealogy that connects the history of deinstitutionalization in mental health with the history of deinstitutionalization in intellectual disabilities by answering that question, but by putting it on its head. So looking at the kind of things that other people have said, quote unquote, caused deinstitutionalization, and seeing why did they focus on those things, and what else happened, like in that time. Not to say that those things did not contribute. So, for example, the the history of Thorazine, I think is really interesting. So one of the things people say, particularly in regards to psychiatric institutions, is that psychiatric institutions closed because drugs were discovered that really helped people with psychiatric disabilities, and now they could live in the community or live outside of institutions. Well, every part of what I just said can be refuted. First of all, drugs were not discovered. They were invented. And they were in fact invented, particularly Thorazine, was invented as a drug to control institutionalized populations. It was not a drug that was meant to get people out. The point of Thorazine, this comes from the really great history of Judith Stacy, Swayze. It's with the W and a Z. It's also really, you know, so to summarize, like the history that she does so well is that the drug Thorazine actually they had a really hard time importing it into the US because psychiatrists were very reluctant to prescribe drugs to institutionalized populations. And so they kind of sold the drugs. First of all, they created like task force within hospitals. So they, you know, did this kind of like direct consumer thing, but direct to psychiatrists very, very earlier on. Like we're talking about the kind of the 40s and 50s. And they created these task forces within hospitals, for example, and to try to kind of sell the drugs as something that would calm the quote-unquote patients and in essence would enable them to be better suited for other therapies. So the point of the drug was not so much to, you know, kind of control people per se, but to control them enough so they're susceptible to other treatments. So this was not a drug that was meant to deinstitutionalize. So it's really interesting that it's seen as that now. And also the fact that it's seen as kind of a panacea for psychiatric treatment when it was used abundantly also in institutions for people with intellectual disabilities. I haven't seen even one account that talks about how Thorazine was the cure that saved people with intellectual disabilities and created deinstitutionalization. There is no such account, I don't think. And so why is it treated so differently, even though it's done on people in the same kind of carceral environments? It's because, this is my analysis, because Thorazine gives us a particular story about how madness works. And it gives us a story about madness that talks about madness as mental illness. And so this is connected again to the kind of genealogy, the history of ideas of the time that psychiatry in this country turned to biopsychiatry. So people that think that this was always the case, it was not always the case. This kind of idea that madness is an illness of the brain or an illness of the mind is actually, you know, relatively new. And so the story really fits this psychiatry kind of claim for quote unquote cure, even though psychiatrists like know that this is a very, mm-hmm. this is not what happened, right, in hospitals at that time. And I'm giving this kind of at length because I do this kind of analysis with every other kind of source of when people say, oh, why was this a cause for deinstitutionalization and how can we activate it in a different context? I try to really actually warn against that. So I'll give one more example and then we can move on because I think this example is actually really, really important for abolition. One of the other causes that people say that led to deinstitutionalization is, like you said, lawsuits and exposés. Deinstitutionalization has been vastly litigated and still is today. And it's litigated not just on an individual basis, like so-and-so gets incarcerated in a particular psychiatric hospital and so on, let's get him out. But I mean more like the class action lawsuits, which was a tremendous thing that happened that I talk about more in a different chapter. But the idea that people have is that these lawsuits and exposés really created the conditions that enabled the liberation of people, because they exposed, as the name exposition suggests, the conditions of confinement of these settings. They exposed how terrible these sites were. They exposed how there really wasn't treatment in these psych facilities, how there really wasn't rehabilitation or habilitation in these institutions for people with intellectual disabilities that were sometimes called schools, but there was no schooling in them. And so I show in the book how this is a very noble kind of notion. And indeed, it's absolutely true that these lawsuits and these exposés politicized people, including people who were institutionalized at that time. This is absolutely true. And activist lawyers and, you know, created organizations, but they did not close down these facilities. And in fact, in many cases, they ended up making these institutions linger on because the effects of these lawsuits and exposés is that then the idea is the conditions of confinement are so bad, why don't we reform it? Why don't we put more money into it and more staff and more people and, you know, move to a better building and construct more things and so on and so on. And so that made these places actually linger on. And to me, that's a really good lesson of the difference between reform and abolition.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, like I was saying, that there are these different forces and they're never completely determinate. And there's also these, as you mentioned here, so much of this, of these traditional histories of deinstitutionalization, seems to value too much the forces that sort of top down forces, especially when we think about policy or when we think about psychiatric expertise, for example. But you do bring up some of this psychiatric expertise in the on the abolition and deinstitutionalization chapter on normalization and the myth of mental illness. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about some of these competing ideas, right? It wasn't just one idea, but some of these competing ideas around mental illness and its relationship to institutionalization and deinstitutionalization.
Sure. So I'll try to kind of be brief. The second chapter really kind of builds on the question that we just ended with, which is if we see the genealogy of ideas as like you were just saying top down as expert knowledges, I wanted to show that there were a lot of other knowledges and resistance movement that really contributed to deinstitutionalization. And I want to be sure that, you know, the whoever listens understands that I'm not saying that I think that those things are the major engine of deinstitutionalization. That's not what I'm saying, because I don't think we can quantify it in those ways. But what I try to kind of find is the thorough line of abolitionist knowledges in deinstitutionalization or abolitionist ideas within deinstitutionalization. So I'm also not saying that everything in deinstitutionalization was abolitionist, like I was just talking about the exposés, for example, that were done out of, you know, extremely well-meaning people. But it wasn't until, this is, again, my analysis, that to me, when I looked at this history, it really wasn't until there was a shift in perspective, like a paradigm shift that occurred, that I started to see abolition in deinstitutionalization, meaning people that said, no more, no more putting people in institutions for people with intellectual disabilities, no more going to doctors and the doctors prescribing for people to be institutionalized, especially kids, right? This was like incredibly pervasive. I don't know how young, people who are listening are, but, generationally, there's like a whole generation that was disappeared into these institutions, right? Like people have like this, oh, I have this aunt I never knew existed and she lived in a psych facility like half her life. Or I have this, uncle that lived in an institution for people with intellectual disabilities. And these places, of course, still exist. But the idea was no more new admissions, no more sending people to these places. And the really radical idea that people, no matter their disability, can and should live in the community with their peers. And again, this was a radical idea. And in the field of intellectual disabilities, I trace it to a pretty controversial kind of ideological and policy construct called the principle of normalization. Mm-hmm. That was imported to the U.S. by Wolf Wolfensberger, who I got to talk with before he passed. And he passed away a few years ago. And he said that like he got death threats for that, for talking about that. And I just want to say for people who don't know, the principle of normalization really comes down to this idea that people should live in as normal as possible environment and this normal as possible cycle of life as their peers. The principle of normalization is not about necessarily normalizing people. But this idea of the principle of normalization and Wolfensberger himself and the people who subscribe to this notion are and should be very much critiqued in disability circles. But what I try to say, I'm not trying to kind of make him look like a hero or something like that, but I'm trying to say that these ideas were very radical like at that time, and they did come from professionals in the field, but they came from these kind of outlier professionals that started to infuse what they probably will never call, but I will call abolitionary kind of mindset in regards to deinstitutionalization. Because if everybody should live with and study with and have access to sexuality with and, all of those things with their peers, then we absolutely don't need things like institutions. And we also don't need things like segregated schools and we also don't, and so on and so on. And so this idea that this came from educators and other people in the field was very radical at that time. And we should also critique it. And I do in the book. And so I show how that, for example, kind of worked, like how these ideas that started to put forward more abolitionary notions in deinstitutionalization, how they kind of infiltrated. So, for instance, people who talked about these things were then asked to go testify in the lawsuits I was talking about earlier, right? To say that people shouldn't be institutionalized in these kind of class action lawsuits and so on. So how their ideas traveled. The second example that I have in this chapter is the example of the anti-psychiatry movement. So how the knowledges of people within MAD movements, anti-psychiatry movements, consumer survivors, ex-patients movements, and those are all, by the way, not necessarily the same people, how their ideas also were abolitionary. Some of them were not abolitionary, but I tried to kind of show the idea between abolition and reform and the movement between abolition and reform in their notions of deinstitutionalization, who and why and how fought for this idea that we shouldn't do this anymore and we should close it down. And by closing it down anti-psychiatry, I mean, some people believed in closing down psychiatric institutions or hospitals, and some also believed in completely the abolition of psychiatry as a field of medicine. And so I show how kind of abolition thinking and ideas worked and didn't work within those movements as well.
Excellent. Yeah. And I want to follow up too with thinking about some of these counter knowledges or counter epistemologies that in the third chapter, which rounds out, you know, what you call the first part of the book, the conceptualizing decarceration part, that in this chapter, I think, at least for me, this was the most interesting, because I think that there's probably been the least written about it, particularly in this context, like from the position of those who have been, you know, institutionalized or incarcerated, that you start to talk about abolition here and decarceration in these broader epistemological frames. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about, you know, some of these, you know, so-called fugitive knowledges. You also talk about maroon knowledge for abolition. And so in this chapter, what's the sort of intervention that you're trying to make here? And how does this help us think about abolition more broadly?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this chapter is really, you know, the first two chapters really talk about what can we learn about deinstitutionalization and what is deinstitutionalization and how it happened and why and what can we learn from it. But the third chapter really tries to kind of connect it already to anti-prison work and to prison abolition work. I mean, abolition is obviously like a thorough line between all the chapters, and the kind of difference between reform and abolition, or reform, non-reformist reforms and abolition, mm-hmm. That I'm happy to kind of talk about more later. So the third chapter constructs what I call DIS epistemology of abolition. DIS epistemology, meaning not just how we know what we know, but also how we need to kind of let go of particular ways of knowing. And this is really, you know, one of the things that I think are incredibly important as a thorough line between these two movements and ideologies and frameworks, is this idea of this epistemology. So let me just say kind of what it is in a few examples and how it works in both contexts. So this epistemology is the idea that, like I said, we need to let go of particular ways of knowing, that abolition of carcerality is an ethic, which is something Ruthie Gilmore, of course, always says. Like, it's not just a practice, but it's an actual ethic. So what I try to say here is that it's also an epistemology. It's also produces specific forms of knowing, not just content of knowledge, but particular forms of knowing and not knowing. So let me be more specific. In the chapter, I talk about how we need to let go of particular attachments to ideas that we have. For example, this idea of we need to wait, right? We don't have all the alternatives right now. Therefore, abolition of prisons, or abolition of institutions, or maybe even abolition of psychiatry might be great, but surely we can't do it right now, right? Like, we have to wait till all the conditions are met and the alternatives are in place. And what I learned from prison abolition work, and definitely from deinstitutionalization, is that it happens when it's effective. it actually happens when you don't wait. And this is what you said at the beginning about maroon knowledges and about fugitive knowledges. You know, this is the knowledge of, if we talk about abolition, you know, abolition comes from abolition of slavery in the transatlantic slave trade. And people weren't waiting. You know, who can't wait, right? I mean, people who are institutionalized, people who are imprisoned, people who were enslaved, those are the people that advocated for abolition under very different ethical premises than the kind of, you know, white abolitionists that also advocated for the abolition of the end of slavery. And so for people who can't wait and couldn't wait, they have a different epistemology of activism and of abolition. And it's a praxis of trial and error. So this is what another sociologist, Thomas Matthiessen, called, he said, abolition is lies in the unfinished, in the sketch. And I think that this is very true to both movements, that deinstitutionalization and prison abolition really is about this process of collectively understanding things and building things while we're living in the present that we have. We don't wait for the ideal conditions. There's a sense of urgency here, right? It's a utopian, but in the kind of queer Jose Munoz talked about, you know, like queer in Cruising Utopia, he talked about, you know, the kind of talking about the then and there while living in the here and now. And this is exactly what I see here as the kind of praxis of abolition. Another example is letting go of this idea that we need to rely on experts to tell us what to do, which is a continuation of what I was just talking about. You know, this idea that somebody can have a definitive pathway as to how to get rid of carceral logics. And this idea that I need to know, like, tell me what to do, I find to be incredibly kind of masculinist and ableist notion of, like, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. But this is not the binary. This is not how this works, right? Like, in actuality, and this is not how it worked in deinstitutionalization, and this is not how it works in prison abolition. This idea that we have to know all the things and tell us what to do, otherwise we won't do it. No, we work collectively and we build together. And so, you know, these are just like a few examples. I bring a lot other examples in the chapter, but, you know, this idea of letting go of particular knowledges and particular attachments to ways of knowing, I think, is incredibly important. It's a work that's done with a lot of humility. I mean, the work of abolition, I think, is what I'm saying. And it's a collective, you know, work towards collective liberation. And it can't be done by, you know, kind of pointing to expertise and waiting and so on.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important lesson. I mean, especially for those who are listening to this as a New Books in Science, Technology, and Society episode, is that there really are a lot of epistemological debates going on here that may not be read as such, right? Between some of these experts and some of these people on the ground, so to speak, even though sometimes, right, there's folks who are in both places. And you know, you definitely utilize your expertise here as a genealogist, if you will, for looking at not just the conceptualizing the different ways of conceptualizing decarceration, but also in thinking about resistance, which brings us to the part two of the book. And so you start off with, in this chapter four, with the title "Why Prisons Are Not the New Asylums." And, you know, I think on the face of it, and I'd love to hear how this chapter came about. I mean, I remember it was a paper that you had published before, but or with the same title, at least, not exactly the same, but this notion of prisons as the new asylums is taking the place of this so-called deinstitutionalization, right? Like away from the psychiatric facilities or asylums into these folks are now being put into prisons. And I think it's a very, for a lot of people, it's a very convincing storyline because you look at how much people have been incarcerated right around that time, right around, you know, in the 1980s in particular. Yet, as you point out, that this gets rid of so many other important structural factors for these two shifts that are happening that are somewhat related, but they're not, one isn't causing the other, you know. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about this intervention you're making around the so-called new asylums and why that, you know, sort of misplaces some of the importance of all this.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question of like how this came about, this intervention. Like many interventions, it really came from anger. So I was just, you know, that narrative is so pervasive and you see it everywhere, really. I mean, from like infographics to in the book, I really talk about this documentary called The New Asylums. Mm-hmm. And at the time when I was writing the majority of the book, I was living in Ohio, and The New Asylums is about a prison in Ohio. And I was also teaching in a prison in Ohio, not the same one. But, you know, I knew like a little bit about that. And that watching that documentary and then seeing how everybody kind of repeats this narrative as a genealogist, it's like a goldmine, right? You're like, just because people repeat it doesn't mean that, it does mean that there's something there in regards to it. It almost becomes like this myth, right? It becomes this story, this fairy tale that we tell. And myths, by the way, I mean it in the kind of semiotic sense. I don't mean it in the sense of something that did not happen. Although I do debunk like a lot of the kind of factually some of the claims here. But as a genealogist, what is interesting to me is like, why why this story and why now? I mean, deinstitutionalization in psychiatric facilities, the peak in psychiatric facility nationally was in the mid 50s. So every year since the mid 50s, there's been less and less psychiatric institutions and people in them. And the closure of psychiatric facilities, you know, is something that it began in the 50s. And the major waves of it have stopped by the 70s. We're in 2021 right now, right? Like, why do I need to watch a documentary in like 2018 about how deinstitutionalization is causing in the present the rise of incarceration? Deinstitutionalization, you know, the great waves of it have long gone, you know, before people who made this documentary were probably born, you know, gone. And so why is this, you know, why is this kind of like being scapegoated? And again, I don't want anybody to listen to come out of this thinking, okay, so what, nobody circles like in and out of psych facilities into prisons and so on. No, of course people do. I mean, that's how carcerality works. And that's also one of my claims in the book is that there's this continuum of confinement that Bernard Harcourt talks about a lot as well. So I don't want people to think, oh, she's saying all of this is false. No, I mean myth as in why is this a cultural myth that we tell ourselves in the US? Like, what is it? What lies under it? And also, what does it hide? And why do we need this myth, right? And because that's what happens with cultural myth. We need them for something. Just like the story of Thorazine, we need it for something. And so otherwise it wouldn't appeal to us. It wouldn't be so kind of taken for granted that psych facilities, in particularly less institutions for people with intellectual disabilities, that's not part of the cultural myth. Psych facilities closed, and then the same people ended up reincarcerated in prisons and jails. And this is also why we have so many people with psychiatric disabilities in prisons today. And it doesn't work factually on a lot of levels either. Like I said, in terms of temporality, you know, deinstitutionalization is something that happened like decades before the rise of incarceration. So you can't say that that's what led to the rise of incarceration. Mm-hmm. You know, most people that are now in prisons and have been in prisons for, you know, the last like two decades at least, or if not three, depending on what state, have never been institutionalized. Definitely not for like a long time, because that era has, you know, shifted. Demographically, it's a very problematic claim, because the rise in incarceration particularly affected men, particularly Black and brown, and especially Black in the United States, which does not mean other groups are not overrepresented. But in the time frame that we're talking about, the rise of incarceration, so we're talking about particularly the 80s and onwards, so 80s, 90s, and so on, we definitely see much more men of color being incarcerated in prisons. These were not the population that were deinstitutionalized necessarily, which were more even in terms of gender distribution and race as well. So it's not like buses left, you know, psych facilities, dumped people in the streets, and then led them to the same people to be incarcerated in prison. Yes, there are quite a few people that cycle in and out of these facilities. Again, this is not to say that that is not happening, but my bigger question is, what does it hide? And it hides various things. One thing that it hides is the fact that, you know, when we say prisons are the new asylums, and Cook County Jail, which is where I live, or LA County Jail are the biggest mental health facilities in the US. People say that. They love to say that. They're the biggest mental health facilities in the US because psychiatric facilities closed, and the most people that we have right now living in congregate facilities are in prison. Well, that claim hides two realities. One is people, it's not like when people were incarcerated in the other facilities, meaning psych facilities, they got treated well or at all often. And so, you know, this idea of let's go back to the great old days of psychiatric institutionalization really hides all the knowledges that I just spoke about for like the last 30 minutes, right? It hides all of the knowledges of disability, mad people, psychiatric survivor, anti-psychiatry, self-advocacy, and so on and so on. So really the autonomy and the self-determination and the knowledge of people with disabilities who have fought for deinstitutionalization. And so, you know, to say that these are now because unfortunately psych facilities closed and we don't have where to put people. People don't need to be put somewhere. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is exactly the problem, not the solution. People need self-determination. People need housing. People need food. People need healthcare system that doesn't exist in the US. People need a lot of things, but they don't need to be put somewhere. And certainly they don't need to be put in carceral spaces, whether they're prisons or jails or psych facilities. And the second thing that this, two more things that this equation hides, this idea of, you know, Cook County Jail is the largest mental health facility in the U.S., is that it's actually not. I mean, it doesn't provide treatment. If you're going to say mental health facility, then you need to actually provide something for people, right? And it hides the fact that prison is disabling and prison is maddening. So if you want to ask, why are there so many quote unquote mentally ill people in prison, start with the prison. I mean, that's what people who are incarcerated tell us, like, time and time again, like, they go crazy in there. And if they come into jails and prisons with already a psychiatric kind of crisis or mental health difference or disability, it usually gets way worse in these facilities. And people who work in these facilities will tell you the same way. Like, there's no, this is not a secret. I mean, if you go into any jail or prison, this is incredibly apparent what's going on. They're not meant to do these things, right? Treatment is not what happens in prisons. Prisons are sites of punishment. And that's what they are. And so it hides that reality. But lastly, and then we can move on, you know, the thing that it really hides is that, like you were saying in your question, two things happened at the same time, which was deinstitutionalization, and then what happened at the same time was basically a major, major social, economic, political abandonment, meaning the complete diffusion of the safety net. And this, you can, you know, now we call it neoliberalism. This is what, you know, Reagan imported into the US from the UK. First as governor and then as president. So neoliberalism happened. And what happened was that money completely vacated social services and housing and healthcare and other things and welfare and went into corrections. So when we think about like the rise of incarceration and kind of the prison building binge and all of that, we really need to think about this hand in hand. And I think it's really kind of, it's really important to not blame deinstitutionalization because, you know, like we say in the social sciences, causation is not, correlation is not causation. Two things happen at the same time does not mean one led to the other thing. It mm-hmm. means there were forces that created both of those things that were above both of those things. And these are, you know, economic and social and ethical and ideological and financial forces. And until we kind of reckon with that, we're really just blaming deinstitutionalization for things it's it did not do.
Right. So you then talk about some of the extension of this carceral logic, right? Because one of the factors here that you mentioned in the new asylums chapters is homelessness and that relationship to incarceration. But you also talked then in the next chapter about segregation, desegregation, and NIMBY. And so I was wondering if you could talk a bit about, you know, some of the tensions there between this, you know, inclusion and exclusion and connection here to race and disability in particular?
Yeah. So I'll only say like a little bit because I know we are, you know, this book is very long. yeah. And I know that we're kind of like running out of time. But, you know, the connection between race and disability is really something that's a thorough line, you know, in all this book. Sometimes I talk about it as race ability, meaning exactly like how these two things are inseparable from each other. And sometimes I talk about the concept of or the process of racial criminal pathologization, which is how criminalization is completely connected to medicalization or pathologizing particular bodies and minds, and how that's completely a racial project. And so in chapter five, I show, and this is similar to kind of what I do in chapters, the last chapter as well. The last chapter is about lawsuits. But in chapter five, I try to connect, I try to show that deinstitutionalization, we can see it or read it also as a desegregation movement. And it worked on parallel and intersecting tracks with desegregation in terms of racial desegregation. I think a lot of people understand what I mean by racial desegregation in housing, right? But I don't think people understand desegregation based on disability, which is something that again completely intersected with race, something that maybe people are less familiar with. So in that chapter, I talk about NIMBY mean not in my backyard. The response to group homes, for example, being constructed in residential areas, particularly residential areas where people are white and middle class, which is also the areas where racial desegregation was the most kind of opposed to. And the tactics that were used for both were very similar. And so I try to kind of show, again, the kind of genealogy of those two things and how they're actually connected to each other. And I do that through, you know, various kind of examples and examples of lawsuits and examples of the tactics that were used in fighting for this against desegregation and the fighting for basically being segregated. We don't want these quote unquote people next door. So I give a lot of different kind of texture to this story. You know, including the fact that one of the things that was done is that they did these like basically notifications that they sometimes did or surveys or town halls in regards to, okay, there's going to be a group home here for people who are recently incarcerated or drug users or people with intellectual disabilities or and so on and so on. What do you think? Right. And what I try to say in the one of the things that I say in this chapter is, why do we do that? You know, again, like really taking the taking for granted and putting it on its head. I mean, if I move to a particular area that I can afford, does somebody come and ask me, hey, I'm going to have a kid. What do you think about that? Like, should I do, not do? I'm also going to adopt a dog. Should I not? You know, like we don't ask people about those things. And so why do we make an exception for particular populations? Why do we go and notify people that there's going to be people with disabilities in their neighborhoods when, you know, and I identify as a person with disabilities. We've been in everybody's neighborhood all the time, you know, and not all disabilities are visible and so on. So, I mean, this is, of course, something that creates a boundary, and it creates the boundaries of us versus them. It creates a boundary around race and around ability and around the construction of those two things together. And I show, you know, through various examples how that worked in the context of housing post deinstitutionalization.
Yeah, and I know we're about out of time, and I don't want to pressure you. So I wanted to just ask before we wrap up a couple questions. One is there anything else since we didn't get to the last couple chapters in much depth, if you want to add anything else about your book, any of the main ideas that you felt like you wanted to speak upon before we end our interview?
First, I want to apologize that the book is so long, but, you know, it's it was really a labor of not just love, but accountability to the complexity of the history and the movements that I'm writing about and with and on. And so I couldn't find a way to be succinct about it, to be honest. And I think it's okay if people don't read everything or if people come back to particular things later on. Every chapter kind of brings its own thematic issue that connects deinstitutionalization to prison abolition. I'll just say, like, very briefly, you know, chapter 6 really brings a more kind of intersectional lens around who works in these facilities and right. who's against the closure of these facilities. Because even if we're all, you know, if everybody reading the book and is like, yes, let's do this, you know, there's a whole history of trying to close prisons and psychiatric institutions and institutions for people with intellectual disabilities that is completely did not work. And so I'm trying to kind of ask, okay, who are these people and groups and constituents that are against the closure of these facilities? And they're not necessarily who you think they are. And then I try to ask, you know, through the connection of gender and race and ability, how are these people connected to each other? And how can we create coalitions then around this resistance to closure? And the last chapter connects prison right litigation to institutional litigation. It's more complex than what I just said, but you know, it's I think it's one of the chapters that's most kind of like current in the sense that it kind of brings us to the now and the notion of what can we take from asking the state to fix things that the state messed up intentionally, right? Like, what does it mean to use the law to get people out when the law put people in? And this is really where I kind of put this idea that, again, runs throughout the book, but I think maybe it's especially in the last chapter, this idea of crip or mad of color critique. How can we bring liberation through frameworks that are not state interventions? And how can we learn from that?
Right, that's so important right now. You have so many people trying to work towards abolition and not knowing so much of this history, and now they can pick up your book and get at least some of that. And it's such a rich book. So even though I'm sad we didn't get to talk about those last couple chapters in depth, you know, it's such a rich book that I took my time to really consume it because it was so rich, and I really hope that the audience does the same. But before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask if you wanted to speak upon any new projects that you're working on, anything else that you wanted to say before we wrap up.
I'll just be pretty vague, but you know, one of the things that I'm doing now is I'm looking at the history of I would say broadly the critiques to psychiatry that are connected to imprisonment, and particularly critiques of psychiatry that we wouldn't necessarily call anti-psychiatry, because the history of anti-psychiatry is pretty white and not super varied. But there's been critiques to this idea of medicalizing people and medicalizing madness and medicalizing race from a variety of movements. And I'm still researching in the same time frame, so the 60s, 70s, and so on. And I'm particularly looking at the kind of examples of trying to biologize violence to, you know, research that kind of looked at violence as something biological. And of course, that's also a racial project and a racist project. So that's kind of the genealogy that I'm tracing right now. And this is also related to the history of behavior modification in prisons and psychosurgery. And it's just really fascinating. And I don't even know what will come of this research, but I'm finding myself really interested. So,
well, yeah, that sounds like an amazing project. I can't wait to hear more about it. Yeah, thanks again for joining us on today's episode. And I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you.